This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day. Thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Today we get the latest on the Ebola crisis from aid agency Oxfam. They're tripling their efforts in Ebola-affected countries. The Bachelor's Blake Garvey is the most despised man in Australia this week after breaking up with his fiancée, Sam. The minute the cameras stopped rolling, we discussed the fallout from that with Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City. Sexologist Dr. Patricia Werikun gives us some tips on how to talk about puberty, sex, and relationships with your children. How tech guy Andrew Morris wades into the debate about whether we're all addicted to our smartphones. Movie reviewer Ben McKechnie dissects the Ben Affleck thriller everyone's talking about, Gone Girl, and asks whether the film is anti-marriage. And we'll meet the new Sydney novelist who's marketing his novel with a big twist. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. Over 3,000 people have died of the Ebola virus, which is nearly half of those who have been infected in the latest outbreak. And for the first time, somebody outside of West Africa has been infected, a nurse who cared for a Spanish priest who caught the disease in West Africa and later died. So people are starting to get concerned naturally. International agency Oxfam is planning to triple their aid to Ebola-affected areas in an attempt to rein in the spread of the disease. Meg Quatermain is a humanitarian manager from Oxfam and she's on the line. Hi, Meg. Can you give us, firstly, a sense of the scale of this crisis? How is it actually affecting people in West Africa today?
Well, firstly, it's multi-country. It's a regional situation, so it's not bounded by one country. Look, the US Centre for Disease Control estimates there could be up to 1.4 million cases across the region by January. As you've said, over 3,000 people have died, and numbers sort of are looking around, possibly up to 6,500 people have already been affected. Mm. It's a critical public health problem.
What are the symptoms of Ebola and why is this disease so devastating?
All right, so the symptoms are fairly standard in infectious diseases, and okay. That's also some of the problems, you know, things like fever, vomiting, diarrhea. A key one in this type of in Ebola is bleeding, but there's also skin rash and muscle and joint pain. So anybody experiencing those symptoms are directed to go to a health facility.
And how does Ebola spread, and why is it spreading so quickly?
All right, so it's spread through direct contact. Now, direct contact means blood or body fluids from an infected person or body that needs to be in direct contact, touch another person's eyes, nose, mouth, or open wounds. So they need an entry point. People can also become infected through contaminated surfaces and materials such as bed sheets and clothing.
So what's the best way of preventing Ebola from spreading further?
All right, so the message is that the public health message is always wash your hands with soap and water, go to a health facility if you're unwell, do not touch people with signs or symptoms or who have passed away, do not touch clothes or bed clothes of people, do not touch their body fluids. In West Africa, the messages for public health are around do not also touch what is called bushmeat or monkeys or baboons or primates, and do not touch bats and excrement of those types.
So is a big part of what needs to happen just spreading these messages widely across West Africa so that people are more educated about this?
Absolutely. As you know, right now, health facilities are overwhelmed. Direct treatment is quite difficult. So the main fight against the disease is to curb the transmission rates and to work preventatively for communities.
Okay, so what sort of work is Oxfam doing to help prevent the spread of Ebola?
Right, so Oxfam has a variety of approaches here. We've already helped over 500,000 people by providing water supplies at treatment and isolation centres, hand washing facilities, community areas, hygiene kits, personal protective clothing to frontline community workers, the training of community health workers, and what we call mass public information campaigns. So around the messages I just mentioned previously, but through radio, through community health workers, and through community messaging.
Is that message starting to get through?
Yes, because there's been a significant ramp up, as you would know, through information recently. So Oxfam itself has tripled its effort in Ebola-hit countries, and so there is a significant scale up across the region for these direct messaging and preventative and preventing transmission activities.
Okay. And so right now, particularly for your organisation, what are the barriers to success? What's holding back the international effort to fight this disease?
Well, as you know, certain logistics and large-scale medical responses need to also be attended to by governments and personnel, military personnel and activities that have this type of logistical muscle. A lot of, as you all know, a lot of the US and British military work is, they have the logistical backup that often a lot of agencies don't have on the ground, especially around medical and treatment centres. Highly trained personnel, the hazmat, hazardous material, those type of things need to be brought forward.
Okay. And so how can Aussies here support your work?
So Oxfam, as we've said, we have a lot of activities ongoing. You can go to the International Crisis Fund at Oxfam, which is oxfam.org.au, and look for International Crisis Fund, and they're the funds we are using to support these activities.
Okay. Thank you very much, Meg.
No, a pleasure.
That's Meg Quatermain. She's the humanitarian manager from Oxfam. You can donate to Oxfam's International Crisis Fund on 1-800-134-134 or go to oxfam.org.au. In the last week, there has been a flurry of chatter around not one, but two celebrity bachelors who've broken their promises for very different reasons. First, there was the reaction to George Clooney's wedding, when the man who vowed he'd never marry again finally tied the knot. Then an even bigger scandal here in Australia when it was discovered that TV's The Bachelor had already broken off his engagement to his TV fiancé, Sam Frost. What does the buzz around both these stories say about our expectations of love and marriage? Joanna Hayes from Celebrity in the City is on the line. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, Joanna, George Clooney is married. I mean, who was the amazing woman to finally tame the untainable George Clooney? She'd have to be like a human rights lawyer or something, wouldn't she? Something amazing like that?
Apparently, / model.
Oh, right, yeah. Very glamorous lady.
Indeed.
Well, yes. He actually has been married before, so he's not a bachelor in that sense. But he had vowed to never marry again, so clearly he must have been trapped into giving up his freedom.
Oh, obviously, you know, she somehow managed to coerce him. Because, you know, why on earth would you marry someone? You just get tied down, you get a ball and chain, you ruin your reputation. Yeah, so, you know, she must have woven some sort of spell over him, obviously.
So why do you think there was such a big reaction to George Clooney no longer being available? Like, any of us were actually going to meet him and marry him anyway.
Well, exactly. So, you know, I think there was partly a bit of jealousy, a bit of like, oh, no, now my impossible fantasy is dashed. But I think also just a bit of the whole, like, it can be a bit of a like, ha, you see, the dream is real. Marriage does lure everyone in the end. We do all want someone to love us forever. So even George Clooney can succumb.
Ah.
I think there's a bit of a sense of, you know, voyeuristic triumph as well for some people.
So maybe it's kind of like that other unattainable guy may one day succumb to my charms.
Yeah. I think that can be a bit of a theme there.
Okay. Let's move on to The Bachelor. I mean, why do you think there's been so much interest in the news that Blake broke it off with Sam?
I think because of the same thing. People are like, I want to believe in love that's forever. I want to believe that, you know, you can make promises to another person and mean them. And, you know, so I think a lot of hearts are kind of broken and people are annoyed and frustrated and possibly reliving some of their own trauma in seeing this guy so clearly, in my opinion, not have meant anything in the first place and then to have broken some quite serious promises that he's made.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a marriage proposal is very sacred, isn't it? And it is a promise.
At least it should be. And I think for me, that's what I find so interesting is that we're in a strangely cynical place as a society about marriage, but we're not cynical at all about love. Everyone still wants it. Everyone is talking about it. And we have shows like The Bachelor, for heaven's sake. So I think, you know, love itself is this overwhelming myth, in a sense, in our society. It's a story that we tell each other over and over again. And yet with a reality TV show that is totally constructed, we're then surprised when the love turns out not to be real.
I know. That's so bizarre because, you know, it's a show where a guy gets his pick of 20 women and gets to know them all very superficially in very contrived situations. They're not actually living life together in a normal way at all.
There's nothing normal about it.
And yet somehow when that, you know, will you marry me thing comes out, we want that to be real.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the desire for eternal love is so strong that everyone wants that to be true. And so, yeah, I think there's disappointment because it's been demonstrated that what we all want can be a bit riskier than we thought. So I think people are jealous about George Clooney, but ultimately happy that he's succumbed and just frustrated and angry that they've been fed a lie by The Bachelor.
So what's the lesson from all this? Don't look to celebrities for love advice.
Well, I think, you know, there's always that. I think for me, I'm, just reflecting on how powerful the desire for love is and therefore also how thoughtful we need to be about what love stories we do digest as real. The Bachelor, not so much. Mm. And, you know, I think it's fair enough that people have a sense of disappointment about it. But I think sometimes we need to remember the love stories that we're told aren't always stories of true love, and perhaps we need to look elsewhere for those.
Okay. Thanks, Joanna.
That's a pleasure.
It's Joanna Hayes from CelibateInTheCity.net. We've been talking about two very different celebrity bachelors, George Clooney and the much despised Blake Garvey. I remember in about sixth grade, my school had a little information session for parents and children where we all received a little booklet called something like, "Maybe you've noticed you're changing." It was all a little bit awkward and embarrassing. Puberty can be a challenging time for both parents and kids. Dr. Patricia Werikun has been a sex educator, researcher and therapist in America, Sri Lanka and Australia for more than 25 years. She's just released a new guide for children 10 to 14 years on puberty, sex and relationship. Patricia joins me this year. Lovely to have you here, Patricia.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
You're becoming quite a prolific author now, aren't you? How many books have you written now?
I think it's 3 books, yeah.
Losing count.
Losing count. It comes with old age.
And you've even got a work of fiction coming out. We'll have to talk about that another time as well.
Yeah, it's partly based on my growing up in Sri Lanka. So that's for another time.
That'll be very interesting. Now, why did you want to write a book about puberty in particular?
When we released the Teen Sex by the Book, which was for 15 plus, we had people coming to us, especially parents, saying, "What about younger children?" So that is when we decided that we wanted to write a book for younger children. Now, I must say that of the 3 books that I've written with CEP Publishing, this is the one that is closest to my heart.
What is it about this book that you're passionate about then?
It's because it goes directly to parents. This book is written specifically to start the conversations. And today, we are so aware of the fact that we need to start talking to our children about relationships, about sexuality, about their body when they are very young.
Okay.
Because sex enters the life of our children when they are 8, 9, 7, primary school. And we can't, as parents, as teachers, as aunties or brothers and sisters, shut our eyes to the fact that our kids are facing issues.
Okay, what do you think are the biggest issues that they're facing at that primary school age?
The biggest issues are basically that they are surrounded by sexual images. Now, we're not just talking advertising media now. We're talking about television shows that almost are mainline shows but have so much of sexuality and even sex that can be classified as pornography, in other words, really explicit. Secondly, the average age for porn exposure in Australia is 11 to 12 years. This means children, if it's an average age, children younger than that are being exposed to explicit sexual material, which of course means that we need to start making children aware of what is good, what is valuable, and just be part of the conversation rather than that one birds and the bees talk.
Okay. What are some of the differences that you think that parents should be aware of between what children face now and what it was like for mum and dad growing up?
Firstly, there's just the changes of puberty. The biological changes are obviously the same, I mean, as they were when the parents were growing up, but puberty age is dropping, which means we need to start talking earlier. But because of the media, because of the peer pressure, kids are a lot more conscious and aware of body changes. And partly, sadly, this is because of media and pornography, because it portrays bodies as quite unreal. And so parents need to be aware that whereas in their time, they were growing up in a very secluded, just a few friends, now the whole world of social media is giving their kids something to compare their bodies with. And we are seeing younger and younger kids with eating disorders and body image problems.
We know we should talk about sex and puberty, but often it can feel awkward or difficult. I could never get my parents to talk about it with me very much. Do you have any tips or guidelines for how to make it less awkward? Is it partly a case of doing it more often?
Well, that's why we wrote the book, because the purpose of the book is to for parents to read it and then give it to the children. And in the book, right through the book, we have sections that says, ask mom and dad. So parents read it, they give it to the kids, and it is a conversation starter. And so give it to your kids and talk about it with them.
Do you think if even if things start awkwardly, that it will get easier as you practice it more and more?
There is no too early to start talking. So what we say is start talking when your kids are actually 4, 5, 6 years old. Start with, you know, what's your body parts? Start talking
where
about
where did your
the right
baby
words.
Brother or sister come from? That
yeah,
kind of thing. Yeah,
simple things like that, which would seem simple except for the parents who are actually starting the conversation. And then, you know, keep the channels of communication open. And then as age appropriate and as, you know, anything comes up on television, in magazines, just use those teachable moments and continue the conversation. So body image, relationships, as kids become to mature a bit more, to understand that friendships are good. You don't have to sexualize friendships. You can have plenty of good friends. Don't think sex, think friends. We need to encourage kids to have plenty of healthy friendships and do things with friends without sexualizing relationships.
Yeah, hard to do in this day and age, isn't it? Well, thanks for that advice, Patricia, and for giving us a bit of an indication of how parents and kids can use this book together. It certainly sounds like something that, that's really all about starting conversations. That's Dr. Patricia Werikoon. She's a sex educator, researcher and therapist. We've been talking about her new book on puberty. It's called Growing Up by the Book. It actually has a PG rating because of some of the anatomical images and the sexual themes. Are you addicted to your smartphone? Because apparently a lot of us are checking our smartphones a lot of the time. Smartphone ownership has more than doubled in the last 4 years. 3/4 of Australians now own a smartphone. Who the other 1/4 are, I don't know. Our Andrew Morris, our new media manager, is here to give us some of the facts about our smartphone addiction. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Katrina. Great to be with you.
Just how attached are we to our smartphones, Andrew?
Well, according to Telstra's Smartphone and Tablet Index, which was a recent survey, they're saying that 84% of us are taking our smartphones wherever we go. 71% of us never turn it off.
Okay.
So, and the stats are that on average, people are checking their phones 150 times a day, some 10 minutes, every 10 minutes. So our affection towards that device is pretty strong. You could say slightly addicted. And there are concerns and more information coming out about Gen Y's behavior. You know, first thing they do is turn their alarm off their smartphone, and before getting out of bed, they've checked their Facebook, Twitters, emails, all that kind of stuff.
I actually find it hard to believe. I mean, 150 times a day, you know, if that's the average, there must be a lot of people checking it even more than that. I don't think I would honestly touch my phone anywhere near that. I think it would probably be 10 times a day at the most.
I think people would be surprised how often they glance at their phone. Like, I probably go, oh, I wouldn't touch it that often. But when you think about it, how often do I check my email? scroll on Facebook, do this, do that. I mean, the phone has been, in 3 years, our phones today that are in our back pockets bending are more powerful than desktops were, say, 3 years ago. So, I mean, the technology is coming across. And if you think about how many items the phone has replaced, you know, whether it's letters, a camera,
the Gregory's in your car.
Yeah, the Gregory's, radio, the phone, alarm clocks, newspapers, photo albums, tape recorders, compasses, video cameras, televisions, Rolodexes, and even white noise machines. You know, you can get an app for anything. So just think how many devices are now sort of relegated to the annals of history, you know, because of that.
You know, this word addiction gets thrown around a lot. You know, people say, oh, you're addicted to this, you're addicted to that. But is it fair to say, do you think that it is actually an addiction for some people?
Oh, for sure, it's an addiction. I mean, when you start picking up your phone and looking at it when you're driving, the fact that you can't drive without looking at your phone, the fact that you are at a lunch with your friend and you can't help but pick up a phone while they're chatting to you and you go, uh-huh, mm-hmm, oh, yeah. I mean,
just get new friends.
But I mean, even it comes down to, I mean, a company like Apple, you know, they do everything. They market research the life out of a phone to find out what people want, and they design it, as someone said, ruthlessly to exploit and manipulate our brain chemistry. Like cigarettes have an effect on us, and junk food has an effect, and all that kind of stuff, or whether it be casinos, you know. So Apple is ruthlessly getting the design and the function so that you won't part with it, and that you'll create habits around that phone and stuff. So yeah.
So it seems like we kind of need to have a little bit of a counter reaction to this, to kind of like self limit in some ways. I mean, if people are actually bumping into each other on the footpath or texting while they're driving, then there's got to be a point at which we kind of go, yeah, no, I'm not picking up the phone.
I mean, it's crazy. In China, you probably heard over the last couple of weeks, they've got now, in certain parts of China, pathways that are assigned to mobile phone users so they don't bump into each other.
Bike paths that have mobile paths.
I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it?
It really is. And look, just to foster a little more iPhone addiction, we have got a New Hope Media app. Awesome. What does that do, Andrew? How many times a day do you need to use that app?
Well, that wasn't a good segue, was it? Yeah, here's all the bad things about smartphones. And by the way,
we're feeding your addiction. Yeah.
Well, we're making it easy for you to find encouragement and good music. We've got a new phone, new iPhone app, which has been updated for iOS 8. So if you want to listen to Hope and see the music that's been played. I can't believe we're talking about this after that segment. But anyway, it's just go to the look for Hope Media Limited in your iTunes store and you can download it or update it. It offers, lots of new features, latest stories, all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
and can you use it on the toilet as well?
Yes. Part of the Cisco did a survey and, they report that Gen Y, some ridiculous amount, a third of Gen Yers in the survey, would not go to the bathroom without their phone.
So listen to Hope on the toilet.
Nah. I think the lesson is don't touch anybody under 30's mobile phones.
No, don't share their iPad or their tablet
phones
either, because that's probably been in the bathroom as well.
Would you like to use my phone? No, it's okay.
Thanks, Andrew.
Cheers.
That's Andrew Morris. We've been talking about smartphone addiction. Imagine your wife disappears and everybody thinks you're responsible. That's the premise behind Gone Girl, the Reese Witherspoon-produced thriller starring Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. Gone Girl is one of the most talked about movies of the year. It stirred up some controversy as well around things like gender roles, its depiction of marriage, and even issues like domestic violence. So what is all the fuss about? Ben McKechnie, our movie reviewer, can hopefully tell us. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Katrina. Yeah, I'll try to shed some light on this for you.
Yeah, well, first, I just want to know, did you actually like it? Is it a good movie?
Yes, I liked it. It's a good movie. It's not great. And it's also, I should mention, it's directed by a guy called David Fincher, who made movies like The Social Network, Fight Club, Seven, Zodiac.
Oh, wow.
Benjamin Button. So this guy's made some amazing movies. So it's stacked up against all of those films. I don't think this one is as good as his best films, but definitely, as you just said, most talked about movie of the year. It's doing big box office around the planet.
Yeah.
And it's the movie that people are talking about right now, and it's the one you'll want to go see because there's not much else around.
Now, Ben, it's a really hard movie to talk about without spoiling the twist. I actually have read reviews that have just laid it all out there. So it's really going to... Totally. So it's just like one on Mamma Mia I read yesterday. So now I know everything that actually happens, which is disappointing. So can you tell us what it's about without swelling the twist?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a professional movie reviewer, so I will not spoil what goes on in the movie. That's
Thank
terrible.
You.
I'll do this as delicately as I can. So Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike, they're the lead actors and actress in this. They're playing a married couple. She disappears, and he increasingly catches the blame for it. And so the movie is kind of a movie of two halves. And really, from what I just said then, that's pretty much all you can tell people about what happens in Gone Girl, because revealing any more does start getting into territory where you can ruin some of the surprise.
Exactly. You know, some stories are told from a particular point of view. So is there a sense that we're seeing it from his point of view, and that he's kind of an innocent man trapped in it? Or, you know, like, does it give you, or is it always left in doubt that you don't know what really happened?
One of the best things about the movie, and we should also say it's based on a book that was released a couple of years ago. It's a very new and very popular best-selling thriller by an author called Gillian Flynn. And so people who've read the book will know that it's told from both perspectives. So it's told from his perspective and her, so the husband and the wife perspective. Mm. It kind of alternates between the two. And one of the best things, most satisfying things about the movie, I think, is it can be very difficult to work out whether you're seeing people's own perspectives on what happened, or whether you actually might be getting a version where they're lying to you. So it's hard, and I think that's one of the really intriguing things about Gone Girl that works for it, especially in the first half. For me, I think the first half of the movie is the best, and the whole mystery around what is going on, I think, is handled really, really well.
Okay. Now, some people have said, though, that it's a rather negative portrayal of a marriage. Do you think the film is anti-marriage?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think... Yeah. We can almost confidently say this because the author of the book, Gillian Flynn, has described marriage as like a con, as like someone, as kind of people cheating each other. Because early on when you first get together, kind of demonstrate the best parts of you, and then when the more each other gets to know of each other, it's like you cheated or lied to each other, and marriage just becomes this kind of dealing with the fact that you're not the people you said you were.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right. And that is the strong message that comes through Gone Girl. So I should point out that there are some moments of violence and some confronting scenes in this movie that a lot of people are talking about, and I think quite rightly, but they will disturb people in a way that you might want to consider not seeing the film. But even with those moments in the movie, across the movie, the big villain of the piece does seem to be marriage. And there's even some lines in the film where I went with my wife, Amy, and we're listening to this stuff, and people, the lead characters in this film are describing marriage as like this place where people just hurt each other and tear each other apart, and they resent each other and they try to control each other. And then one of the couple just says, well, that's marriage. And like, what?
Oh, no. Like, I'm sure there are marriages like that, but it seems a very one-sided view.
I'm not saying that Gone Girl, that she or the director, David Fincher, are trying to say that this is exactly how marriage is, but it's a very, very cynical film.
Okay.
And at the very least, it's so strongly put in the movie that you walk away with this bad taste in your mouth as if, like, marriage is a bad thing.
So maybe don't go with your wife or your husband.
Hopefully your marriage is, A, a lot better than the one that's presented on screen, and B, hopefully your marriage is one that represents way more what God intends of marriage. It's unity, and it's two people together, not two people apart, trying to get what they want. So hopefully if you go as a married couple, you'll come out reflecting on how much better it is to be united than divided.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a good thing to get out of the movie. So thank you, Ben. That's our film reviewer, Ben McKechnie. We've been talking about Gone Girl. It is rated MA. It stars Rosamund Pike, Neil Patrick Harris and Ben Affleck. Anyone who wants to be a writer knows it's notoriously hard to get a book published, especially a first novel. So to stand out from the slush pile, new author and Sydney sider James Evangelindis decided to do something a little different. His book, Maze of Keys, contains a puzzle, and if you solve it, you could win thousands or perhaps even millions of dollars. And the more copies of the book he sells, the more the prize money goes up. James Evangelindis is on the phone. Hi, James.
Katrina, good morning. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, why did you decide to publish your book in such an unconventional way?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Katrina, when you said that it's really, really difficult in a crowded, not just an Australian market, because this is a global project to actually stand out from the crowd, because in any one year around the world, there's over 100,000 fiction books that come out into the market. And let me ask you the question, what percentage of that 100,000 titles plus do you think sell any significant number globally?
It's probably like 1%.
Well, you're almost right. It's actually between 0.5 of 1%
okay.
and 1%. So basically, there are less than 1,000 titles globally
yeah.
that sell any significant number. So I needed to basically try to do something. Some people say, is this a gimmick, James? And so, well, if it looks like a duck and sounds like a duck, it's a duck. It is a gimmick of sorts, but I thought it would be fun.
But the thing is, okay, so you've got an interesting gimmick, but we need to know about the book. Have you written a book before, James?
I've only written, well, this is my first fiction work, my first okay. novel. My background is as a business author. I've written 6 books in the very exciting fields of accounting, law and financial planning.
Okay, but that's all kind of handy if you're writing a thriller, because think about The Firm, John Grisham. You got to know all that stuff about law, business, accounting, etc. in the background. So what's Maze of Keys about, and who would enjoy reading it?
Okay, Maze of Keys, as I mentioned before, it's a thriller, and it's essentially a book about a guy by the name of Joshua Keys, hence the title. And Joshua Keys is a New York-based headhunter who is caught in the middle, is probably a better way to put it, between his biggest client and this crazy European ultra-rich madwoman who's hell-bent on revenge on his client, and he's caught directly in the middle. And it's sort of got everything. I wanted to actually, because of my faith, wanted to write a story that didn't have sex in it, didn't have lots of swear words or drugs or all that. Now, it has a bit of violence, but most of it is implied, not overt.
Okay.
And the people that would enjoy reading it, basically one of my all-time favorite authors in this particular genre is John Grisham. So it's like John Grisham without the law.
Okay. John Grisham without the law. Let's go to the prize money now. If people want to have a shot at winning that, what do they have to do?
All they have to do is buy the book from our website. It's not available on Amazon or Apple. It's only on our website, mazeofkeys.com. And all they have to do is download the book. It's an e-book, and you can read it on any device, iPad, Kindle, Kobo, whatever, laptop, phone even. And you basically pay $15 US. You download the book, you read the book, and then you download, or at the same time you download the book, you can download a copy of the puzzle. The puzzle consists of 7 questions.
Okay, and what happens if nobody solves the puzzle? Have people already solved it? Or
Without putting too fine a point on it, we've sold a number of books already, and we've done a random spot check on people that have answered the puzzle so far,
yeah.
and the puzzle is solvable, and I can actually say, without putting too fine a point on it, because the contest ends at the end of October, so people have, you know, just under 3 weeks to buy the book and solve the puzzle. All the clues are in the book. It helps to have Google and so forth, perhaps
okay.
for some extraneous things, but someone actually has solved it. You don't have to be an Einstein to solve it, but then again, a 12-year-old child would have trouble doing it.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's enough to keep it interesting. And now you're also supporting 3 charities, aren't you? So tell us
yes.
about those.
3 charities are, everyone's heard of World Vision, so that's the first one. The second one is a group called Hands Across the Water, which is basically set up by an Australian chap in the wake of the tsunami in 2004 on Boxing Day. One of the huge outcomes of that were a lot of kids who basically lost their families. Mm-hmm. So what this particular charity does is establish education programs, accommodation programs, food, health, the whole bit, and they've been doing it now for almost 10 years, so really
Great.
Believe in their work.
Excellent.
And the other charity is the Crossroads Foundation, based in Hong Kong, who do wonderful work.
And so how are the charities getting their money? How does that work?
A dollar from every book
okay.
goes to them.
Thank you, James, for telling us all about it.
Katrina, thank you.
And it's James Evangelidis. He's the author of Maze of Keys. You can find it online at mazeofkeys.com.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.